Thank you, John. Good morning, everybody. It's almost afternoon. Let's get started straight into it. The Emerging Accessible Technology session. Emerging technologies come in many forms, and they're really revolutionizing the way we do things nowadays. First up, we'll start with a personal perspective on making the most of emerging accessible technologies. And for this, we have all the way from New Zealand, Jonathan Mose. And I'm not sure if I'm the only one who thinks we're having a Kiwi invasion. We have had Ron Hooton, or we have Jonathan Mose. Oh, maybe that's why they still haven't formed the government, because all the important New Zealanders are in Australia, I suppose. Well, maybe just a quick background about Jonathan Mose. From Mosen Consulting in New Zealand. He currently lives with his wife Bonnie and four children in Wellington. He has a Bachelor of Arts in History and a Master's in Public Policy, from the Victoria University of Wellington, and also a successful broadcasting career as both a host and a director. 1999, he became the first congenitally blind person to stand for Parliament in New Zealand, and he was twice national president of the Association of Blind Citizens New Zealand, and also chairman of the board of the Royal New Zealand Foundation for the Blind. He founded ACB Radio, which is a well-known radio service for American Council of the Blind, and he also became the president of Blindness Hardware Products at Freedom Scientific, where he still hosts the weekly FS Cast show, which is all about JAWS, as many of you will probably be aware. Together with his wife Bonnie, he now operates a company called Mosen Consulting, where they produce high quality learning material, audiobooks, and the iOS without the I, which many of you will be familiar with. So, weekly internet show, Mosen Explosion, and also a very good podcast. If you haven't subscribed to it, I can highly recommend The Blind Side. And without further ado, can I ask you all to welcome Jonathan Mosen?
Thank you so much, Francois, for the generous introduction. And all I can say is that I'm glad you didn't ask me to speak at 6 o'clock, or I'd have to learn to speak Australian. It is a real pleasure to be here at another BCA convention. It's been a wee while since I've been here. And I'm here today to talk about a range of technological subjects. And when I was asked to talk about emerging technologies and making the most of emerging technologies, I thought that it would be easy to fill the time that I've been allocated with discussion about all the amazing gadgets that we now have access to. And we do have a lot of gadgets that we have access to, and we've made a lot of progress. And the good thing about technology is that even if it makes your hair go grey, the thing is, if you do exactly the same thing in exactly the same order with exactly the same conditions, it does actually respond exactly the same way, even if it's not the way that you want it to. Children, not so much. Now, my youngest is actually 14 now, and my oldest is about to get married, and so I'm over the days of children saying embarrassing, inappropriate things. Mostly. And the other day, actually, I gave my 17-year-old son, who's really into his fitness and things, I gave him an Apple Watch because I got the new Series 3, so he got the old Apple Watch. And he kept asking me these questions, "Dad, how do I do such and such on the Apple Watch?" And I said to him after a while, "David, why don't you read the manual from the Apple Store? You can go and download it and read the book, and it's got lots of pretty pictures, and you'll enjoy that." Now, as you will know, if you're involved in technology, if you've been on technology email lists or that sort of thing, you will know that there's an acronym for this. And yeah, somebody already gets it. The acronym is RTFM, which, of course, as we all know, stands for Read the Flaming Manual. I was very good, and I didn't use that acronym because I knew that David would ask me what it stood for. And But his reply to my suggestion was, "Dad, why on earth should I read manuals when I have you for a dad?" And it's great, you know, we've come a long way. I'm not terribly mechanically inclined, and what I know about gardening could fit in a tweet, and that's 140 characters long. But it's great to be the person when you go home at Christmas time who fixes everybody's technology problems. And it's great that as blind people we can do that. So we have come a long way. But there is something serious I want to discuss today. And it's something that I've been looking for a venue to raise for a wee while. And I think that this is the appropriate venue, particularly given your theme. The disability movement has really been founded on a mantra, and it's used so often that it's become a bit of a cliche. Nothing about us without us. And if you want to know how important that mantra, that slogan, is to our future, then you only need look at how well it has worked in our past. We can go all the way back in a technological context to Louis Braille. Louis Braille invented a system of raised dots for the blind, and without it, I wouldn't have been able to do many of the jobs that I have done in my life. Nearly 200 years later, it's still relevant, it's still critical. What was the response? Sighted people didn't approve. Sighted people wanted to ban it. Some sighted people even literally burned it. It was blind people who invented and championed Braille. A little bit later, quite a little bit later, a blind man had a car accident, and he decided that it was going to be the beginning of a new journey, not the end of his life story. He educated himself in computers, and he started a company, and that company was called Hinterjoyce. And a little bit later, another blind guy, Glenn Gordon, came along and really cracked access to Windows at a time when many of us were starting to despair about whether we were going to lose everything that we had gained in the DOS environment. We as blind people solve that problems. And that's not to say that partnerships aren't important, because partnerships have borne fruit too. It was a chance meeting on a plane between a blind man and a brilliant mind named Ray Kurzweil that caused the first reading machine to be invented. It was partnerships between people like Dean Blasey of Blasey Engineering and Russell Smith of the company we now call Humanware that meant that we as blind people were using note takers long before sighted people had portable devices. We made that happen in partnership and cooperation, but we partnered with people who listened to us. They didn't assume what we needed. They asked us, "What do you need?" We told them, and they turned their genius to the problem. In parallel with this, there has been a discussion going on in the consumer movement around the world, and that essentially said that technology should be accessible out of the box. You shouldn't have to retrofit it. Universal accessibility should be something that is just accepted. And so it was, particularly in the United States, where often, at least in earlier times, we used to follow their example. The Americans with Disabilities Act was formed, was passed ultimately, and of course Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act. And what that said was that if you are a technology manufacturer, you have a very good chance of having your technology bought by government and used widely if you make it accessible. Or by contrast, if you don't, if you choose to ignore the access needs of people with disabilities, you have a good chance of losing some significant government money. Now, it was that climate that we as a consumer movement talked about, agreed upon, and voted upon. It was that climate that led probably the most successful company in embracing universal design, Apple, to come to the table, because Apple had nowhere else to go. The last company to make a third-party screen reader for Apple had pulled out, and that's why Apple had to come in and do it themselves, originally on the Mac, and there's no doubt now that accessibility is in their very corporate DNA. And that's a wonderful thing. When a company goes into a new geographical market, they do a lot of research. So if they're going into a market like China or India, they will find out what is culturally appropriate. They will work closely with people with knowledge of that culture, and so it should be. In the blind community, I submit that we have a little bit of a problem. It is important to wake up in the morning and be thankful for how far we've come and be grateful for the fact that as of 2009, VoiceOver, for example, is built into every iPhone. Now, the term game changer is used a lot, but that really was a game changer, to have such a powerful screen reader in every product. But let me paint a picture for you. A new version of Apple's operating system is released, and people suddenly find that one of the most fundamental, one of the core functions of that device no longer works, namely that you can't answer calls anymore. The whole world comes to a screeching halt, and it's headline news. The newscaster is breathless as he headlines the bulletin and says, well, it's a she, because it's Ness Campanella, right? So it's a she. And the newscaster says, e-commerce ground to a halt today as people couldn't communicate with one another because Apple released a software update and you can't answer your calls anymore. And there are live interviews with tradespeople and salespeople and people from all walks of life who've had their livelihoods disrupted. Tim Cook gives an emergency press conference and he apologizes and he says it's not good enough. And he says the technicians will work through the night and get a fix out tomorrow. Now, that exact thing happened in iOS 9. But the only difference is it just affected blind people. Lots of people got their iPhones updated to iOS 9 and they couldn't answer calls anymore. How many journalists were interested? None. Did Tim Cook have to make an apology? No, he did not. No journalist even brought it to his attention. The fix, well, it did come, but it was very late in coming and it caused a lot of loss of revenue for many people. And if you think that I'm just raking up ancient history, ask any Braille user about what's going on in iOS 11. What is going on in iOS 11 with Braille is not acceptable. And I think we need to ask the very important question. If a bug would not be deemed acceptable for a sighted person to put up with, why is it acceptable that we should put up with it? As equal citizens in any country, we are equally protected by consumer guarantee legislation. So the legislation doesn't say a product must remain fit for purpose unless you happen to be blind. Every assistive technology company should be held to the same standards. And when a manufacturer develops a screen reader, be it Google or Apple or Microsoft or Amazon, they have chosen to become an assistive technology company. I've worked as a product manager in two of the biggest assistive technology companies in the world in the blindness space, and I know that this technology has an enormous power for good when it works, and it can be incredibly disruptive when it doesn't. And so understandably, blind people have held assistive technology companies to account. They expect technology to work. They know that it can never be bug-free, but they do expect that if some showstoppers slip through, that they will be dealt with in a timely manner. We have had repeated examples, not just with Apple, but with a number of other manufacturers too, where serious bugs have been reported in the design stage, in the beta testing stage. Apple now allows people to public beta test their software, which means that if you want, you can put the version of the next big thing on your device and test it and report back to Apple. Apple got a lot of feedback about the no answering call problem before iOS 9. They got a tremendous amount of feedback about the Braille problems that persist in iOS 11. And if you think the Braille issues are bad now, there's a new issue that I believe is a ill-considered feature coming in 11.1 that is going to drive everybody crazy. There's also, of course, the recent issue with the actions rotor in email, which if you read my blog and listen to my podcast, you will know I've been talking about, and that, it looks like, is being resolved, where Apple chose unilaterally to make decisions that caused people to inadvertently delete email because the operating system worked differently in that one application. So what is the answer? Well, the answer is that in all of these assistive technology cases, whether it be the dedicated assistive technology companies or the big entities, the big corporates who do a lot of other things besides assistive technology, we must be partners. Just as when they go into a new geographical market and they look at the culture of the market they're going into, our culture needs to be considered. And what is that culture? Our culture is nothing about us without us. Our culture is that we expect that when these products are manufactured, we will have a say, and that representatives of companies will get around the table with us at a meaningful stage and not just pay lip service, but listen to and implement our ideas. Because what history has taught us is that we make real progress when we are the people with whom things are done, not the people for whom things are done. I have recently been talking to people who have purchased multi-$1,000 note takers, and the only reason why they still feel that they need to do that is because they're concerned about what happens every time they upgrade their mainstream device. We won't have achieved the equality that we seek until we send this simple message. We are worthy. We are worthy of a product just as capable, just as consistent, just as bug-free, that allows us to communicate with our family, our friends, our business associates with ease as sighted people. And until we get there, we won't be able to make the most of emerging technologies. And so I would urge this organization to consider what tools it has at its disposal in terms of disability discrimination legislation, in terms of consumer guarantee legislation, to say that when a major bug is released by any mainstream manufacturer that would not be acceptable for anybody else, we say, not so fast. We use the tools at our disposal to level the playing field. And so those are my thoughts on some of the challenges we face in making the most of emerging technologies, and I'm happy to take some comments or questions.
Not working. Thanks very much, Jonathan. If we can have a question from the floor, that'll be good.
Thanks, Jonathan. I would like to, Graham Innes, I would like to absolutely support what you've said to us today, and you've challenged us to think through these sorts of issues and use legislation to that effect. When Sydney Trains told everyone who could see where they were, but not anyone who couldn't, I took action to address that, and you used the example of the iOS 9 and not answering calls. You weren't, for very good reasons, able to refer to the other example in Australia, which is the standout in this case, which is the Albert Terminal, which, if it had been rolled out where sighted people needed to go and do a training course before they could use it, Commonwealth Bank customers would have walked away in droves. And I stand with Emma Bennison and Lauren Henley and other staff and members of BCA in calling out the Commonwealth Bank for that, and I will continue to challenge that until it is rectified.
John, any final comments from you before we move on?
Yeah, Graham, I think one thing I would say in response to that is that accessibility and usability are quite different things. And so it is possible for people to argue that something is accessible, but really I think we also need to ensure that you don't have to be some sort of computer scientist to complete basic tasks.
Cool. Thank you very much, Jonathan. I think he just reiterated the fact that it's not going to change if we just sit back and hope for it to change. We actually have to make it happen and make sure that we are included. Thank you very much. So I'm sure there'll be lots of more burning questions, but please feel free. I'm sure Jonathan will be more than happy to speak to you over lunch and over dinner. That's what we're all here for, to connect and share ideas. So next up, I think the buzz earlier this year was all about autonomous vehicles and the fact that autonomous vehicle trials were supposed to start in Victoria this year. So an update on that would be, that's one of the things we're looking forward to, because it's also very important to ensure that the needs of people who are blind and vision impaired are not overlooked. Similar to the silent vehicle, also the self-driving vehicle. We want to be out there and included, and it should work for us just like it works for everybody else. So we're very fortunate today to have Councillor Steve Hurd with us today. He's in an ideal position to talk about driverless cars and also other ways that advanced technology augment the way that people with vision impairment live their lives. Just a quick background on him. Steve attended the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind and until the age of 12, where he boarded for most of the time. And then after mainstream high school, he went on to study law at Monash University. And back in 1985, I believe, him and some friends formed an organization called PENI, People for Equality, Not Institutionalization. So even from an early age, he was already an activist and being involved in the community, as he still is today. And that really was brought about to speed up changes in the disability field. He also previously served on the National Executive of BCA, and he was a past president of the Melbourne branch. Currently, he's serving his second term as a councillor at Boroondara, and he's also an honorary fellow of the Centre for Eye Research. His vision is to impact self-driving cars for people with disability, and also to explore other opportunities in emerging technologies. Consummate speaker, singer, songwriter, actor, Steve Hurd. Ladies and gentlemen, please make him welcome.
Thank you, and it's fantastic to be back at a BCA convention again, and I thank John and I thank the directors, Emma and Francois, for organising this. I also thank Jonathan and Graham for their recent contributions, and I did hear some of the other contributions, in particular Lauren's and Tony's, I found really interesting. And I guess what I'm hopefully about to say will build upon what they've been saying, because I guess the theme that's coming through this is partnership. The necessity for good partnerships, for working together to achieve things, because in a strange sort of way, we blind people do have the vision in terms of accessible technology. I think we can find the way and we can build that way, and that's what we're hoping to do. The project I'm involved with emerged out of two things. One, that yes, I was a councillor and I was at a function once and I was talking about autonomous cars. Years ago, when I worked in blindness agencies, I'd talk about autonomous cars and I was working at guide dogs and they'd laugh and they'd go, good on you, Steve, you get your autonomous car. And I'd say, no, this is going to happen. And this is something that will happen in the future. And gradually, people are actually realising that, in fact, it will. I was having this discussion with Kate Taylor, who is the daughter of Professor Hugh Taylor, who many people will have heard of. And she said, look, you really should speak to Jonathan Crowston at SARA, the Centre for Eye Research, about this, Professor Crowston. And I did. And so we got together and said, would really like to do something in this field. Also at the same time, I was working with someone else who you all might know, Jeff McNeil, who then was a councillor in East Gippsland, a vision impaired person. And we thought we're working on employment issues, and we identified that the biggest barriers to employment are technological, and that includes transport, attitudinal, and it's the attitude of employers as well as the attitudes of people with disabilities. And of course, the other barrier is simply knowledge, that a lot of people don't simply know what we can do. So I suppose that could be a next to attitudinal as well. So we started an idea, we built a service, two aspects. The first is called the Technological Adaptation Development, Technological Adaptation Research Development and Implementation Service, Operation TARDIS. Now, we picked there's a few Hovians out there, I see. And we picked that for a very good reason. The TARDIS, as people may know, is the size of a telephone box, and yet when you walk into it, it is huge. And so what we're trying to show to, and this builds on what Jonathan said, what we're trying to show to developers such as Google and Tesla, etc., you make small changes to the design of your products, and it will A, make big changes in the lives of people with disabilities, but B, and more significantly, save you people big costs further on. And that's, I guess, the central aspect of the image of the TARDIS. Now, the other aspect of this project is called, it's called Project DARE, Disability Advocacy Research on Employment, but the other aspect is called It's the Vibe. And we're going to create a media platform. Now, many of you may have seen the film The Castle. And when the lawyer goes into the court and a man's about to have his house sold and the whole neighbourhood's going to have their houses demolished, and this suburban lawyer who goes into this appeals court and just doesn't know what he's about. He goes, it's wrong, it's just the vibe. It's the vibe. And the judge goes, the vibe. But it is the vibe. So the vibe is going to be about getting the talented people who have disabilities to write about issues. Not necessarily disability. Most of it won't be disability, but a little bit of a disability, you know, thing in there. So we can market ourselves, build our networks to influence people in the media. So if you want to interview some footballer, some rock star, and you can do a good interview, well, you go and interview that person. And as these people meet more people with vision impairments, they'll get to understand our needs more and build our networks, and we'll become much more influential. So those are the two aspects of the project. Now, the first part, and I'm only announcing it here today at BCA, we haven't sort of said it publicly before, we saved it for this convention, is about the things like autonomous cars and the Google technology, like Google Home and Amazon Echoes, and how that can be augmented to assist us even more. With the autonomous cars, and this is the main one, in the industry they have five classifications from a level one to a level five autonomous car. A level one is a completely manual vintage car. Level two is probably, you know, your 1950s, 60s cars. They may have automatic transmission, but that's about it. Level three is getting towards your cruise control, much more computerized technology. Level four is a car that can travel by itself without a driver, however it does have a steering wheel and pedals. And level five is a completely autonomous vehicle that has no steering wheel or no pedals. Now, people like John Simpson and Graham and Bill Jolly are going to remember when we first talked about audible traffic lights in the 80s and the late 70s, the attitude of many of the bureaucrats in roads who'd never had anything to do with us before would go, don't know about these traffic lights. It's a big budget impost. I don't know whether we can do this and blah, blah, blah. And there is a bit of that attitude in the engineering industry now. And of course, we did do audio traffic lights and people didn't die and the sky didn't fall. And there's a bit of that in the industry now. Some people are saying, oh, no, this won't happen until, you know, another 50 or 100 years. Well, it will happen, and it will happen before then. It won't be like colour TV, where they said, well, from March the 1st, 1975, we'll turn on colour TV, and there'll be a few tests for 6 months before, but, you know, that's it. No, it'll be something that happens on a number of levels, and it will happen over a period of time. When cars, and the other thing that will make it happen quickly is the speed of designing this technology. There's a company in the US called Local Motors, and they had a competition to build an accessible bus for people with disabilities that was completely autonomous. And it's called Ollie, because a guy in Germany, I believe it was, put in the entry and suggested the design. It took them 3 months to design this car, and it took them 45 hours to 3D print it. 45 hours. Now, when Holden or Ford design a car, it's 3 years just to plan the thing, 2 years to display the concept, and another 5 years to make it a production model. So that's how quickly this technology is now moving. So for people who think it's not going to happen before, you know, 2050, they're wrong. It will happen before, and it will happen on a number of different levels. Now, I, in my capacity as a councillor with our mayor, we met some people from Swinburne the other day who are into this technology, and they were saying that, you know, there are all sorts of levels of autonomy, but there are things that are going to be coming out soon. It won't be just cars that we get in and buy. It'll be how people use cars. So Uber will be using them. All these companies will be using them, and there'll be other autonomous vehicles which are like pods that you go from your car park to the shops, or you go from the station to the shops. And the mayor and I had an idea, because guide dogs in Kew is very inaccessible by public transport. You know, run an accessible bus from guide dogs to the local train station in Boroondara, where I'm a councillor. Those sorts of applications will come well before, you know, maybe not even well before, but significantly before we buy our own cars. But we may well. The NRMA estimates that by 2035 there will be 1 million autonomous cars on Australian roads. The RACV seem a lot more conservative. They seem to be sort of blocking it, but it's the insurance industry that's going to drive this. Now, here's the challenge, though. The challenge is that if we don't advocate on this now, we're going to end up in a position like Jonathan outlined with Windows, where we're going to be trying to get everything reverse engineered, and it will take a lot longer. And we may actually lose the accessibility that we have now, like in iOS 9, to taxis and things like that, because they'll be working off automated systems. The other thing that may happen, and I actually had heard chatter about this, and I actually checked it up with academics before I spoke today because I wanted to make sure there was credibility in this, that one of the things that will be happening too is there will be flying vehicles, and they may be accessible, flying autonomous vehicles, and they may be accessible before road-based vehicles. There are vehicles now, it estimates that it takes 2 to 3 minutes to cross the CBD of a major city. So these vehicles have 20 minutes battery power, but they do short trips. And there'll be other vehicles that are... one of the professors I spoke to saw a factory in China whereby they were able to build a 20-person battery-powered plane that could do your sort of Melbourne to Geelong, Sydney to Newcastle kind of trip really easily. And these things have been invented now. These things have been invented now, and they are being deployed soon. So if we work individually, I think our future could be good. If we keep doing what we're doing, it will be great. But if we can work together, it might just be fantastic. Thank you.
Wow, exciting stuff. We have some time for questions from the floor.
Hi there, it's Susan Thompson. I don't know which one of our speakers I really need to direct this to, maybe both, but it seems to me that we have a couple of major challenges. One of the things that's problematic at the moment is that we can't escape this technology. It's coming and we're stuck. Well, when I say we're stuck with it, it's a great thing if we can actually get access to it. But how do we ensure that you don't need to be a rocket scientist to operate it as someone with a vision impairment? And going along with that is the difficulty for a lot of older people who lose their vision later in life to learn to interact with this technology, because currently, even to use, in my opinion, the iPhone with when you lose your vision later in life and you have to develop all these new skills, and even to use the internet with JAWS if you've never had to operate that way, is no fool's game.
I'm happy to start the ball rolling, if that's okay. Firstly, I think there will always be people that aren't comfortable with technology. But I would also hope that if we got in the practical terms of... And it's a good question, Sue, because I've felt the same thing and put the same issues. That basically, if we have to allow for an interface that can work for all people. So if you're comfortable working with an app, that's fine. The Uber app, for example, is reasonably accessible. But it can be a bit tricky at certain times. And as Jonathan said, they can change them very quickly and we can lose access. And that's one of another danger, not just for older people or people who aren't as comfortable with technology, but for everybody. But I think we do need to plan that, and they are talking about having, for example, with the autonomous flying devices, having a service that if there's any problems, you get put through to a person that you can actually speak to and they'll fix things up. So I think that that would be the kind of service that they would need to implement. Jonathan, what?
It's a really challenging question you ask, Susan, and I'm glad you did. Initially, we spent a lot of time thinking about just how does a blind person get access to this environment. So Windows was pretty pictures, and for a long time people thought blind people couldn't access Windows because Windows was fundamentally graphical. So initially it was the technical challenges that had to be overcome. And obviously Apple did something absolutely remarkable, which others have copied, relating to how can you create a user interface that allows a blind person to use a touchscreen at all. Now we do have to face the fact that the vast majority of blind people are over the age of 65. They're adventitiously blind, so they've gone blind later in life. And for some, you know, not all, it is a huge challenge. It may become less so because as baby boomers age, they have grown up with computers, and we have to just find ways to sort of migrate those skills that they have to a non-visual context. But I hold a lot of hope for voice interface. I see a lot of people using devices like the Amazon Echo and the Google Home. I think Google Home is... I think they're both officially available here now, aren't they?
Yes.
In Australia? Yeah, right, okay. In New Zealand, they're not, but you can sort of import them. But I see people... I see people with very minimal computer skills who are getting really meaningful things done with a voice-based interface. And as those devices become more contextual, more intelligent, I do hold out some hope for that. Even in the last couple of days, you've got a situation where Google Home and Amazon Alexa, sorry to all the people listening on the stream who have one, I've just sent your Alexa off. Alexa, buy a book from Mosen Consulting. There you go. just in the last couple of days, they have actually got voice sensitive. So Bonnie and I love using our Amazon Echoes, and now it understands which is me and which is Bonnie. So they will get better over time, and I think voice has a lot of promise for that, you know, not for rocket scientists thing.
It's not being developed.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you. Is there one quick question and a quick wrap-up answer?
As somebody who started school at the end of the Second World War, who started computers in education at Auckland University in 1983 on the DOS system, I've been learning ever since. And I personally am offended when my generation are spoken about the old people who have difficulty in learning. You know, I'm here from Brisbane at this conference because I bloody well want to learn. Right. I want to learn.
Good on you. What a positive note.
Well, absolutely. That's a great thing. I think my point is to say that a lot of older people are struggling with a whole bunch of things. So people who've become blind later in life, they are dealing with new forms of literacy, new challenges. And I actually worked in the field of rehabilitation for some time for the Blindness Agency in New Zealand. And I met prisoners of war, former prisoners of war, who had just been through things that I couldn't possibly imagine. But when they became blind later in their life, it was like their life had ended. And so those are the people that I'm thinking about. How can we ensure that those people who don't have that resilience, that sense of get up and go, how do we make sure they're not left out too?
Yeah, I use the term struggle with technology, and that could be anyone. My father was fully sighted. And remember the old days when you used to buy talks and things like that? You'd have to Bluetooth them onto your phone before you could make it talk. So I'm trying to get my father to turn on Bluetooth on this new mobile phone. He's going, "Where's the bloody switch?" I go, "There's no switch. You do it on the menu." "Well, I'm bloody stupid then. I can't find a switch." So even the concept of turning something on with a menu for some people... And my father wasn't very old then. I mean, he was in his 60s, but his generation just hadn't done it. So there are going to be those issues.
Great. Thanks, everybody. And remember, this is not the conversation. Doesn't have to end here. This is what convention is for. So thank you very much, everybody. Next up, the Kiwi invasion continues. we have with us Blake Eisen. He's a blindness Product Specialist for Humanware Australasia, and he's here to talk to us about the BrailleNote Touch, which is a revolutionary device which makes it easier for the blind to touch the future. Now, mindful of the time and that it's almost lunch, people are hungry, I'm not going to tell you his life story, but please feel free to go see him and other exhibitors at the expo afterwards. But for now, I'll give you Blake Eisen.
Thank you, Francois. And I'm not sure whether I like being referred to as a Kiwi or not, being a naturalised Aussie. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you the world's first Google-certified Braille product, the BrailleNote Touch. Now, it hasn't got the capability to fly or to drive itself or anything of that nature. What the BrailleNote Touch is, as I said, it's the world's first Google-certified Braille tablet. Not only does it now bring together the use of the standard Braille keyboard that we're used to on most BrailleNote takers, but it now has the capability to download third-party apps and has used the accessibility obtained through Android and the Android operating system in conjunction with our system called Keysoft in order that it can produce and deliver to you as the blind user the most accessible and most entertaining applications available on the Android system. Have you ever wished that you could just use a quick computer to quickly open, navigate, and listen to a talking book? Well, now you can with the BrailleNote Touch's Victor Reader Stream app, or Victor Reader app. Have you ever thought that you'd like to use a computer or use a note taker to simply read a power bill or read a letter? Or even check a lotto ticket. You never know what you might have won. Well, now, with our KNFB Reader app that we have inputted onto the Touch, you can do that. We also have what's called first letter navigation. So with some note takers, you may know that you have to space down or navigate down to a certain element or to a certain application. But with first letter navigation, you now have the capability, say if you wanted to get to Word, rather than spacing down until you got to Word, you'd simply press W and you'd be right there. But one of the most innovative and important and exciting features of the BrailleNote Touch is its touchscreen. Not only can you utilise this to undertake gestures like you would on your iPhone or Android device, but you can also type standard Braille on the touchscreen. What does this mean? Well, it means that if you're at work, university, school, or another environment where you need to be totally silent, you can be. No longer do you have the significant clicks of the Braille keyboard, but you can type totally silently and totally flawlessly using the BrailleNote Touch's touchscreen. Additionally to this, or secondarily to this, it means that you can collaborate now with sighted peers and have the capability to read what you... They have the capability now to read what you write rather than having to know Braille. Additionally to this, you can actually disable the accessibility side of the BrailleNote Touch so that a sighted peer, if you are collaborating on a piece of work or other note-taking or what have you, can actually write down something that they would like you to read, re-enable accessibility, and straight away you can actually utilise the device to read the Braille or listen to the speech and know what your sighted peers have written instantaneously. So previously you may be aware you had to save the file outside of a Braille format, translate it and then pop it on a USB for the sighted person to read. No longer. The BrailleNote Touch is automatically configured. The BrailleNote Touch is automatically configured to save in a DOC or DOCX format, which means that most versions or all versions of Windows and most versions of Apple Macs can read those documents flawlessly, write feedback or notes, or even correct formatting, and send it straight back to you either via email or USB. So that makes life a lot easier for both the sighted user and, more importantly, the blind user, because it allows us to streamline what we are doing, navigate with ease, use apps that have previously been inaccessible, such as KNFB Reader, navigate quickly to apps like YouTube, Facebook, Messenger, Skype, which you can also use Skype on the machine because it actually has a camera on the back, which if you care to come into the Eureka Room a little bit later this afternoon, I'm happy to demonstrate how that camera actually works. Where else can you find some technology that we have? Well, as I said just now, in the Eureka Room, in the Novotel here, we have a table set up with all of our low vision magnification software and also our Braille software, such as the Braille Note Touch, the Victor Reader Stream, the Brailliant, and maybe even a couple of new products that we have available set up that you can come and try, you can look at purchasing, and you can just have a general chat to myself and my colleague Nelson about how it's done, what you need to do, and what we can do to assist you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll open the floor up to questions if there are any fire ahead.
Hi Blake, Ross Devent here. I don't know if you remember, I met you several months ago when you were down in Rosebud at an expo.
I certainly do.
And we were talking about at the time, we were having a play around with the Braille Note Touch. And while I was impressed with the with what it could do with brailing on it, I was pointed out that it was very difficult for me to use because my right hand doesn't work, so I only can use a Braille Note Taker with my left hand. So I'm just wondering if you took that back to the company.
I did, Ross, yes. And we are now working on, and we'll very shortly have available, a one-handed calibration so that you can now use a touch screen with simply either your left or your right hand, depending on your preference and depending on how that will work for you. So, yes, we do have that available. Well, we will have that available, rather, in the next, hopefully, 2 to 3 months.
Right, a final question before we break for lunch.
Hello, Blake. It's Martin Stewart. The Victor Reader Stream Tracker, I think it's called.
Yep.
Is that Bluetooth capable? And when putting in addresses for GPS, will you have to use the numerical keypad? And if so, would they ever think about introducing a voice interactive system for the GPS?
Martin, the Victor Trek does have Bluetooth capability. It is coming out in Australia shortly. They are, yes, to answer your question, you do need to use the numeric keypad at this point in time to enter in an address. They are, I've been advised, considering at this point how they can mitigate that necessity and use voice control such as, VoiceOver or Siri to actually enter an address. An issue that they are going to have that they are currently attempting to rectify is pronunciation of street names, cities, all that sort of thing, so they are currently working on that as we speak.
Great. Thank you very much, Blake. I'm sure there's many more questions around. Please make your way to the expo, and I'm sure Blake and Nelson will be more than happy to answer them for you. Thanks, everybody, for putting up with us and fighting the hunger pangs. I'll hand you back to John now. John Simpson will be making a few announcements regarding lunch. Thank you.
Thanks, Francois. And please thank Francois and the panel for the session.